Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. These days, it may seem like it's a coder's world, and we're just living in it, which is true. Whether it's algorithms that curate our news feeds, revolutionary apps, or cars that drive themselves, our world is made out of code. And it's only a matter of time until radio shows and podcasts start creating themselves. I'll bet they already are. Journalist Clive Thompson is the author of Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. The book takes you inside the heads of coders.
The people who get drawn to coding and who find they really love it tend to have a couple of traits, I found, when I talked to, you know, I guess about 200 of them.
Wow.
So some of them, I think, are the ones you'd expect. Like, they're pretty good at being logical and systematic. They love, you know, solving puzzles by breaking them down into little steps, you know. They're very precise people. Like, you have to be. When you're coding, if you put a semicolon in the wrong place, 10,000 lines of code can just stop working instantly. So they're incredibly meticulous people. And sometimes, you know, that even comes out when I'm talking to them or interviewing them or emailing with them. They're incredibly precise with the way they talk sometimes and the way they use language. In some respects, I think that's kind of the stuff that maybe people would expect. But I also found some kind of unexpected things, right? Like,
yeah.
They often are very, they're very enthralled by and maybe even obsessed with efficiency and taking things that are slow or involve a lot of repetition and scut work. They love getting in there and figuring out how to automate that, how to speed it up, how to torque it up. And it just brings them in like almost sort of a spiritual joy.
Yeah.
They feel appalled when they see something being done inefficiently, and they love the feeling of, hey, I wrote the code that sped this up.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So yeah. So there's definitely character types, totally.
You think you can do our whole job in 2 days?
I know I can do it in 2 days. I pound Mellow Yellow, Oreos, and Adderall, and I don't sleep until I'm done.
So is it fair to say then that coding is less about making things and it's more about fixing things?
You know, actually, that's a great point. I really think it is. I think if you were to poll all the coders that are out there working today, how many of them are building, you know, kind of cool new apps or adding interesting new features to what their software does? That's a tiny percentage. Most of them are just showing up at work and like, wow, something broke last night, or something stopped working, or someone tried to add a new feature and it broke everything. And they are just in there trying to figure out what went wrong.
Yeah. So is there a certain kind of mental state that coders tend to have?
One of the things that the mental state that coders really need to get into is what that flow state that the MIT professor Michaeli Csikszentmihalyi talks about.
Yeah.
And that is the state of deep, deep immersion in the job at hand. Because, you know, whether you're writing code and trying to debug something that's not working, or whether you're one of these people that showed up at work and something's broken, you got to fix it, it requires you to sort of build this mental palace in your head, right? What's the flow of this piece of software? You know, it's supposed to do this, and then this is supposed to happen. And if that happens, that's supposed to happen. So it can take, you know, many minutes or even many hours of, like, looking at the code and stepping through it in your mind to be able to inhabit exactly what's going on. And it's only at that deep, deep, deep immersion that you can begin to really do the hard work. And once you're in there, you want to stay there. So I would hear coders tell me that, like, you know, they go to their job during the day, but because of all the meetings and people, you know, tapping them on the shoulder, they really can't get any of that deep dive work done. So they do little bits of work during the day, but the hardcore stuff happens at 8 o'clock at night. They get home and they get in that trance and they're there until 3 or 4 in the morning. And that's when the real work gets done.
Something is happening. When you left, I thought he was fried. Okay? Because his shoulders were all tight, and he wouldn't answer to his name, and his eyes went dead. But then he just got stronger. Richard has finished the scheduler and is almost ready to merge the serverless runtime. Look, look.
He implemented all those tasks by himself? I was supposed to take the whole team 4 days.
They have a need for intellectual immersion that, you know, almost reminds me of what you hear artists like novelists or painters talking about, where they get deep in that trance of creativity and they're just there for like 24 solid hours and they come out the other end stumbling into the light.
Yeah, which makes me think, you mentioned that it's very similar to an artist's creative state that you often throughout the book, you talk about the coding being similar to poetry. Can you explain
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. There's something very similar, I think, about the art and craft of writing good code and the art and craft of writing good poetry. Because in the case of poetry, one of the things that poetry often does very well is express an awful lot in a very short space. Mm-hmm. You get one or two lines and they're just absolutely perfect. And they ring like a bell, but they open up all these things inside your mind. And so there's a compression to good poetry that is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And it is very similar in code where, you know, you could write the really complicated, you know, ugly way to do this. But if you're like a really good coder or an attentive one, you try and shrink it. You try and do it in fewer lines so that it's easier to glance at and understand what's really going on. So there's this elegance and economy and parsimonious to good coding that is really a delight and joy to a lot of coders.
Mm-hmm. There's this compression and using the fewest words possible. Like Raymond Carver probably would have been a good coder.
Yeah, yeah. Or T.S. Eliot.
Yeah,
or, you know, actually, you know who would have been great? Emily Dickinson. Okay. So you read, she'll have like, you know, like five or six lines and it's just, oh my, how did you do that? Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. I mean, so fantastic,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
I am done. Look at this. Woo! Code sprint over. Okay.
That was an out-of-body experience. It was like God was coding through me.
If so much of coding is looking for mistakes, a coder must experience this really euphoric high when he or she writes successful code or fixes a bug. Is that the case?
Oh my God, absolutely. And it's funny. So I did a little bit of coding when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, back in those like, you know, days when you had computers you plugged into a TV.
Yeah.
And you did BASIC.
Right.
But I didn't really do much throughout my 20s and 30s, you know. And in my 40s, I decided, okay, I'm interested in writing this book. So let me take some of the new programming languages and learn a little bit of them. JavaScript, Python. And so I started doing this stuff and teaching myself online. And I immediately discovered this phenomena of, wow, I'm just grinding away and this stuff is not working. Mm. But the moment I got it to work, you know, my wife sort of got used to hearing me, you know, from across the room, or maybe I was upstairs, just she'd hear this whoop of joy because, you know, I'd finally figured it out. And I'll tell you, I don't think I feel that jolt of pleasure in any of my professional work as a writer. Nothing really compares, you know? And that's interesting.
Yeah,
right?
It's very interesting. You write in the book, you discovered that it was much more satisfying to program than to write. Why?
I think the reason why I found it more fun and rewarding to program than to write is because writing is an act of persuasion. Mm-hmm. I can't really tell you whether or not my book or my article is objectively good or whether it's working, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's in the eye of the beholder. I have to convince the audience that I've made a good argument, that I've done good research. So it's up to them. But with coding, you know, when I write a little piece of code and I'm trying to accomplish a task and it's finally working, there's a binary sort of pass-fail nature to that. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't come to me and tell me that code isn't working. It is. It is a machine. It is doing what I wanted it to do. So there's this sense of crisp clarity in the wins of coding that isn't really there in the wins of writing, you know? Like, I mean, and I just sort of enjoyed the clarity of those wins.
But there's no chance that you would ever give up writing and take up coding full time, is there?
I don't think so. I think I like what I do too much. But here's what I have discovered about myself, and I think this carries some lessons for the rest of society, which is that I've found that knowing a little bit of coding transforms me into being a much more effective journalist. Because I now write little pieces of code to help me with various parts of my journalism, you know? I can use them to sort of analyze text, or I can take something repetitive I'm doing and speed it up, or make it routine so I don't have to think about it anymore. And to me, this is really interesting because there's been this movement of people saying that, you know, everyone should learn to code, or, you know, we should teach coding mandatorily at the high school level. I think sometimes there's this unrealistic idea that the average person, you know, in middle life could change their life by becoming a coder and getting a job in Silicon Valley and writing software. I think that can happen. I know it's happened. But honestly, what's more valuable in learning to code is to be able to take what you're already doing for a living and become better at it.
Yeah, good advice. Speaking of this idea of learning to code, recently the phrase learn to code started showing up on Twitter to mock journalists who were being laid off from their jobs. So I'm curious to know what you as a journalist and a sometime coder think about this learn to code
theme. Sure. Well, I followed that. And what happened was that a bunch of journalists got laid off.
Yeah.
And so some of the folks in sort of the alt-right, you know, sort of troll swamps decided that they would mock these journalists by saying, hey, laid off journalists, just learn to code. And so they took something that, you know, was otherwise a perfectly inoffensive and even, you know, nice sort of piece of advice, and they were just using it to sort of like mock what they perceived to be the uselessness of journalists. It was, shall we say, not a good faith argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I definitely think, you know, you can make a good faith argument. You can say to people, this is a fun an entertaining and potentially valuable thing to learn a little bit of. And as it happens, I actually think a lot of journalists would be quite good at it. But, you know, that only obtains if you're coming at it from a good faith point of view.
She was head of engineering at Earcast?
She was engineering at Earcast. She built that whole system on her own.
You know what else excites me here? There's a distinct overrepresentation of men in this company. Look around. I think it would behoove us to prioritize hiring a woman.
When coding first became a job in the 1950s and 60s, women were considered naturals. In fact, they were often pioneers, but now there aren't nearly as many women, percentage-wise, working in coding. What happened?
Well, what happened is that coding drifted away from being, you know, an open door that rewarded merit. In the early days, no one knew how to code, you know, the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s. So if you were a university or company that had a computer and you needed coders, you would hire anyone who was just kind of good at solving puzzles or logic and then train them on the job. And that meant it was a very open door, and a lot of women who are, you know, perfectly good at puzzle solving and logic walked in. But over the next few decades, what started happening is that software became much more critical and important and financially significant for companies, and they started deciding, okay, we need to hire coders who could move upwards in management, who could become vice presidents and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And in the very sexist 70s, there was no way they were going to put a woman in charge of men. So at the same time as this industry is becoming very crucial, women are getting pushed out, even women with a lot of experience, because of the sexism and even the policies and laws of the time. So, you know, it's been like a 20, 30-year journey in that regard, and finally there's some attention being paid to it, and there's definitely way more women flowing in to study computer science right now. It's in the last 5 years, it's been a big uptick. What remains to be seen is whether or not the industry itself can evolve to accommodate all the women who are graduating and want to move into those significant roles.
Yeah. There are also fewer Black and Latino coders, right?
Very few, yeah. I mean, the numbers are in the single digits in most places. And at very elite companies, you know, it can be as low as 1% or 2%. And that is for some of the same reasons, which is to say, you know, they simply had far fewer opportunities. You know,
yeah.
If you look at everything ranging from the digital divide, like who's got broadband and who doesn't,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, makes it a lot harder to
learn
programming if you don't have ready access to the internet, because that's where it's at, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I was just looking at the statistics. So 2018, you know, something like 72% of white families had broadband at home in America. And for Hispanics, it was down at like 53%.
Wow.
And for African Americans, it was like 62%. So that you see these really big deltas, and they correlate directly with socioeconomic status. So you sort of see just that opportunity to learn at home or to learn in a school. You know, you're at a school. Schools in the well-off neighborhoods, they have computer science. Schools in the poor districts, they don't.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things all, you know, work to sort of create these choke points that have prevented a lot of people of color from getting into coding.
Yeah. What do you think that we as a society lose when we have so few women and people of color working as coders?
Well, on the one hand, just as a matter of economic opportunity, you know, no society should stand, for that type of thing, particularly a society like the United States that has historically prided itself on being more open, you know, like, you know, whoever you are, wherever you come from, you're supposed to be able to make it here, right?
Yeah.
But there's also a level at which you don't get software designed as well when a small, you know, monolithic or monoculture of people are creating it, you know? I heard from, say, the people who were early into designing things like Twitter or Facebook, that one of the reasons why those companies, you know, took a long time to understand that, you know, harassment, you know, or crazy white supremacy was something they were going to have to need to deal with, was because they were mostly young guys, young white guys running those companies, starting those companies. And it was just, you know, it's just not in their experience. They don't really deal with a lot of systematic abuse heaped on them because of their identity. The way that women might online, or African-Americans might online, or Hispanics might online. So they were simply just less attuned to that as a design element, something that they should have thought about when they were designing how the software works, how to curtail abuse. If you're designing software for the broad mass of the public and the world, you really want to have people involved in creating it and coding it and designing it who understand all those different use cases. Yeah. That's why it's better to have a slightly more diverse team building software for the masses.
Clive Thompson is the author of Coders: The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. You can find out more about Clive at wpr.org/beta. We've run out of code for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Well, I am just a T-bone kind of guy.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'll tell you what's insane. The price that I could get you on a new desktop computer.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You stole my Jesus fish, didn't you?